Holloway versus Commonwealth, Anthony and Celeste, Helen Thomas, Elizabeth Fitzgerald, Attorney General, Catherine.
May it please the court.
Hold on. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anthony Sylvester. I'm from Hopewell, Virginia. I'm court-appointed to represent the appellant in this matter, Javonte Holloway. Your Honors, I'd like to reserve approximately 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, we're here this morning on an appeal that came out of Prince George Circuit Court. My client, Mr. Holloway, was convicted of various drug offenses, a handgun offense, and a felony child neglect charge. The material facts in this case aren't in dispute. My client was driving in Prince George County, where he was pulled over by Officer Dalton for a air freshener hanging from his rearview mirror. Subsequent to his stop, various narcotics, paraphernalia, and substances were recovered in the vehicle. In the back seat was his child, a 3-year-old who was seat-belted in a child safety seat. There were, in addition to Mr. Holloway and his 3-year-old, 2 other occupants in the vehicle. The vehicle in question was a 2001 Chrysler Sebring. The issues that bring us here this morning are first and foremost whether or not the officer had reasonable, articulable suspicion to stop my client, Mr. Holloway, based solely on the fact that he had an air freshener hanging from his rearview mirror. And secondly, the second assignment of error is whether or not, given the other things that I've listed in terms of what was found in the car, whether or not the evidence was sufficient for the court to find him guilty of felony child neglect. Your Honor, with regards to the first assignment, this case finds itself immediately...
Help us understand how Mason is not controlling.
Your Honor, I think it's not controlling because Mason stands for the proposition that, in essence, an officer couldn't really explain or articulate why he stopped a car. In the course of that motion to suppress, there were a lot of issues with regards to, well, why did the officer actually stop him? And, in fact, in that case, actually counsel from Hopewell, ironically, made issue with regards to the Heim case and whether or not the officer had to be able to articulate why exactly was it that he stopped the officer. And so in this case, you have the exact opposite. You have essentially an officer that can articulate, but to the exclusion of anything else, he has identified the size alone as the reason for the stop.
So how does Mason not hurt you worse than you think? Because Mason, the officer didn't expressly articulate it from the witness stand. This officer actually did expressly articulate it. It's a stronger case for the Commonwealth than Mason was.
I think because in the Mason case, Justice Powell raises the issue in terms of the perspective. Whose perspective is in question when you're looking at an assessment of 46-2-1054? It's the perspective of the driver. So it's the driver's view through the windshield that the officer has to make an assessment, a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
But the point you're making now was a point made by the dissent.
I agree. I understand.
The majority held that that wasn't the law, that if you could reasonably hypothesize a factual basis for reasonable suspicion, that to go beyond that is trying to get into the subjective motivations of the officer, and under U.S. Supreme Court precedent, at least to date, you can't do that.
I don't disagree. Okay. Obviously, his subjective motivations are not a question. He testified consistently without any difference in his testimony.
The point is this. If he had said, suppose hypothetical, the officer said from the witness stand, I don't like air fresheners. I just don't like them. I don't like them anymore, and I like parking passes, and that's why I stopped the vehicle. If nonetheless, in fact, the opaque nature of the thing hanging violated the traffic statute, it doesn't matter what he thought or didn't think. It just matters what the truth is.
Well, the standard is whether or not it's objectively reasonable for him to believe that the driver's vision is obstructed, if his clear view is obstructed.
It's objectively reasonable for a reasonable, objective officer. That's the point of Mason. Not this officer or that officer, but a reasonably objective officer, because the Fourth Amendment is wholly objective in its analysis, not subjective.
And Mr. Holloway's contention is that it is objectively unreasonable to believe that an item that takes up less than 1% of the windshield, 0.685% of the windshield.
But that's not the test of Mason either. If you're sitting in a driver's seat and the thing is there and there's a car coming on a ramp there and 50% of that field of vision is blocked, the law says don't do that. It's too much risk. If you hit someone, you could kill them. You don't need the air freshener that bad, or put it somewhere else. What's wrong with that? It's
this
not
officer
a trifling
isn't,
principle.
Excuse me. This officer isn't making that assessment. He clearly says, in fact, at one point, and to be clear, while he uses a 3.5x5 index card standard, he uses that, in essence, to help the court understand he is talking specifically about an air freshener. But the issue there, again, is he has said in the motion to suppress that it is as simple as the color of a car. He is making no further assessment. He is not making, in the totality of the circumstances, he has identified the equivalent of the color of a car without reference to anything else. And the statute says it's the driver's perspective. That at that point, what distinguishes this case from Mason is that he's not looking at anything else. And when you're talking about a per se, so it is a per se rule that he's adopted. And furthermore, it's a per se rule that has used a less than 1% windshield ratio to decide that that criminal activity may be afoot, that there might be a violation of that code section. And Mr. Holloway's contention and our contention this morning is that the officer has to go beyond that. The Supreme Court, this court, has given officers wide breadth to consider a number of factors. One would think that when the focus of the statute is the vision of the driver, that an objectively reasonable officer would consider the size of the vehicle, the size of the windshield, the size of the driver. My grandfather was 5'2". He drove a 1970.
All in a split second as he passes it on a highway?
This officer testified that he goes through a process. As any trainer.
You're talking about, you just talked about the reasonable officer. So you
a reason. Yes, sir. A reasonable officer
would
can
have
make
to do
that
all
assessment.
Those calculations. Would have to say, this is not 0.06, this is 0.1. Therefore, I'll pull this one over. I won't pull this one over.
Now, what I'm suggesting respectfully is that the officer consider the size of the driver, because that's what the General Assembly has asked him to do. I'm not prescribing any actions to him or any requirement to him that the General Assembly didn't put in the statute. And so for him to make that assessment, officers reasonable officers make split assessments all the time. It's in their routine training.
But he's not convicting the driver. He's not even arresting the driver. All he's doing is saying, stop for a second, I want to talk to you. Reasonable suspicion is even below probable cause, and probable cause is below preponderance, and preponderance is below clear and convincing, and clear and convincing is below reasonable doubt. We're way down the ladder of burden of persuasion.
Agreed. And in the original Terry case, we even allowed the officer to conclude that individually innocent-looking cues to an officer in their collection may suggest something to a trained officer, to a reasonable, objectively reasonable officer that would suggest nothing to you or me.
Mm-hmm.
But in this particular case,
let me put something out on the table that is really what we're all concerned about, but nobody's going to say it. I'm concerned about it, if nobody else is. This is a standard that would permit quietly racial profiling. That's the problem with a statute like this. We don't know. There's no evidence in this case that motivated the officer. And I've obviously raised it because we're trying to interpret how do you deal with a statute that lets an officer make the stop based on reasonable, articulable suspicion. Not a string of beads, not a tassel from graduation, but something the size of an index card is hanging from the rearview mirror. And I was a trial judge. I was a lawyer, obviously. And I know that racial profiling goes on in America. And everything, when you look at something like this, And you say, what is the possibility for mischief in allowing these kinds of calculations to be made? There's no evidence of it in this case. It is an issue, however, in how this statute is actually enforced. I don't know of any better way to enforce it at this point in time except to be vigilant for what we're really concerned about. It's not in this case.
I don't disagree with your concern. I'm a defense attorney. I read that transcript. I've read it maybe 15, 20 times. And every time I read it, a little dog whistle goes off in my head. And I'm not making any statements beyond when I hear an officer try to describe an air freshener by referencing a 3x5 card, then there's something there. And in parts of his transcript when he talks about multiple air fresheners. So it's a concern. The other concern is that we know what's going to happen after this case. I mean, defense attorneys know, I'm sure the court knows. This case fails because an officer says, all I have to look at is an air freshener, and I can pull you under reasonable, articulable suspicion. And guess what? Then that's the standard. That is the rule. That's what's been applied by this court for the statute.
Pulling a vehicle for violation of the visibility statute doesn't mean you can search the vehicle. What it means is that you can stop the vehicle and have a brief encounter. So if you don't have five illegal drugs and a loaded handgun and you're running a drug operation out of your vehicle, it's not a big deal.
But that puts the cart before the horse. If I've got that object hanging from my rearview mirror, my life has still been interrupted. People get in their cars, thousands of people get in their cars, they look at what they can hang from their rearview mirror, and they make an objective, reasonable assessment as to whether or not that obstructs my view. That's a reasonable driver. And in this particular case, that officer did not make that basic assessment. He never considered the perspective of the driver, and the statute says you should.
You realize the Court of Appeals and two unpublished opinions have already ruled on this issue. One of them involved pretty much exactly the same air freshener. This was all before Mason.
The significant difference, and again, that's an unpublished opinion, the dimensions are ironic. They're close. The materially different factor in that case is that the officer, when he pulled around behind in Humphreys, when he pulled behind him, he said he could not see. He could see where that dangling object or suspended object, the air freshener, would obstruct his view looking back through the windshield. So I think that is significantly different. So he made that observation, then he pulled the individual. In this particular case, the officer said, I'm pulling him. Lastly, I've got very little time left. With regards to felony child neglect in the context of Coombs, the court here basically said that he's a full-time drug dealer. He's got his child in the back seat. However, there's a difference between, without disturbing his finding, which I disagree with, obviously, but with regards to the present activity, he wasn't in a drug deal, and I think that's the fine line.
And there's no evidence that he was going to or coming back from a drug deal.
Exactly, and I think that's the material. If in Coombs, this court's going to hold that somebody that is obviously driving while impaired, intoxicated, but there's no other evidence that the child was endangered based on her driving. In this particular case, there's no evidence that he was about to go or had just left the drug deal. In fact, the evidence was to the contrary. His mother testified he was on his way to the hospital. Being in business full-time, again, I disagree, but without disturbing the trial court's finding, doesn't necessarily conclude that danger is there in front of him 24 hours a day.
The man had a veritable illicit pharmacy in his car.
Pardon me?
He had a veritable illicit pharmacy in his car and a loaded weapon. Can we not look at the totality of the evidence and say that's sufficient under these circumstances? And that's what the trial judge found.
The totality of the evidence also should include the fact that that child was restrained in the back seat, that there were two other adults, that they were not within his reach. They were actually concealed from the officers until he did a search of the vehicle. But again, that's not what he held. He didn't hold that the child had access to him. He basically said because he's a 24-hour drug dealer and he's a mobile pharmacy, that's felony child neglect. And that is an inherent risk, but it's not a risk that's right there materialized in front of the child at that time. And again, the totality of the evidence would suggest to the contrary that he was going somewhere else at that particular time, as testified by his mother. So I think that finding, I'm asking the court to find that was in clear error. With regards to the motion to suppress, I'm asking this court to reverse the trial court and suppress the evidence of the search. Thank you.
Ms. Fitzgerald.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. Officer Dalton's traffic stop of the defendant's vehicle in this case did not violate the Fourth Amendment, and the evidence that was subsequently obtained in that stop was sufficient to convict the defendant of child neglect. Accordingly, the verdict of the Court of Appeals and the trial judge in this case should be affirmed. Officer Dalton's traffic stop of the defendant's vehicle did not violate the Fourth Amendment because Officer Dalton had reasonable suspicion, reasonable, articulable, and in fact articulated suspicion in this case, that the approximately 3x5-inch opaque Christmas tree air freshener hanging from the defendant's rearview mirror was sufficient to obstruct his vision in violation of Code Section 46.2.
Do we know if this was like on a string that could dangle, or was it fixed so that it wasn't going to move around?
Officer Dalton didn't say that it was swaying when he observed it. However, the parties put into evidence a replica of the air freshener, and that does have a string on it. And so, of course, if it's hanging from a string, it gives it an extra 3 or 4 inches there.
Right, because it can, depending on how you turn or brake or whatever, it could move in front of your field of vision more or less.
Certainly, Your Honor. And significantly in this case, Officer Dalton testified that he had received police training that an object this size could obstruct a driver's vision in a car. And in fact, he had personally sat in a vehicle, looked out the front window, and seen that an object this size could obstruct the driver's vision in this car. Officer Dalton was entitled to rely on his training experience as well as his observations that day to come to the reasonable conclusion that this object was possibly in violation of this code section. This case is substantially similar to this court's recent opinion in Mason, where the court again held that another 3x5-inch opaque object gave a police officer reasonable suspicion sufficient for a traffic stop. Again, as the court noted previously, what we're dealing with here is reasonable suspicion. It's a low bar. The relevant question for Fourth Amendment purposes is not whether this object did in fact obstruct this defendant's vision, but whether a reasonable officer under those circumstances could conclude that it might, sufficient to stop and confirm or dispel that suspicion. We're not dealing with proof beyond reasonable doubt. We're not dealing with probable cause, as the court noted. And under this low bar, this police officer, in light of his training and experience and his proper understanding of the law, unlike the officer in Mason, this officer was able to articulate the purpose.
May I interrupt you with a question? Could a reasonable fact finder infer that the way the drug operation appeared to be running out of this vehicle put that child in a neglect-level risk?
Yes, Your Honor. And I would
let me ask you a question. What evidence is there that any drug operation was run out of this car?
Certainly, Your Honor.
The guy was riding around with an air freshener. That's all I heard the testimony say.
So the air freshener was the basis for the traffic stop. But once the police officer did search the car, the subsequent evidence that was uncovered is evidence of an ongoing drug activity from that vehicle. And the trial court, in fact, found.
What is the evidence of that, other than the drugs were in the car?
Yes, Your Honor. So first, the defendant was convicted of 5 counts of possession with intent to distribute, which requires a present intent to distribute. Secondly, this defendant had a loaded handgun, semi-automatic weapon within arm's reach. He had over $700 of crumpled money in his front pockets, which
well,
the Commonwealth
expert... Let me follow up on that point. Because I thought, now you have to have an intent to distribute them as opposed to consume them. But I didn't think you had to have an intent to distribute them right this moment. So in other words, police roll out to a house with a search warrant, and in a closet or in a safe is a whole bunch of, you know, a kilo of cocaine. Well, that's not personal use, so he's going to distribute it. But he's not dealing it right now. He may go out over the weekend or next month and sell it. So it seems like we're moving in a subtly different direction that we haven't required in this case.
Yes, Your Honor. And to be clear, that present intent, the intent to distribute, has to be contemporaneous with the possession of those drugs. However, that present intent combined with the other circumstances that were present in the vehicle is what supports the trial court's reasonable inference that the drug activity was ongoing in this case.
So he was convicted.
I mean, like he was trying to sell drugs on his way to the hospital. What do you mean by ongoing?
Well, Your Honor, the defendant testified that he was on his way to the hospital for a birth of his second child. His mother testified that she was on her way to the hospital to visit a child that had already been born. And the trial court was certainly entitled to reject his self-serving testimony regarding where he was going. But the trial court also noted, importantly, that there was furtive movement towards that center console, and that the parties, especially the driver, had those furtive movements, and the driver was turning around and then looking at the police car as it passed. And that is, of course, where all the drugs were found.
How many counts of possession with intent was he convicted of?
Five, Your Honor.
So we have five counts of possession with intent, which requires intent to distribute at the time the possession is occurring, which is in the vehicle, not at the hospital parking lot waiting for his second child. And that's law of the case, because it's not been appealed and it's not before us. And
but to me, that doesn't answer the question, because you could find a brick of cocaine in somebody's mansion somewhere. That doesn't mean they sell the cocaine from their mansion. It means they sell it. They could be charged with distribution because it's there. It doesn't tell us where they're selling from.
Certainly, Your Honor. But when that person has scales in the trunk and $700 of crumpled, unsorted money in their front...
And all that would be in that mansion, too.
Well, Your Honor, in the close confines of a two-door sedan, this defendant brought all of this illegal drugs, Schedule 1 and 2 drugs, serious drugs, methamphetamine, heroin, oxycodone.
Yes, you found him guilty of all those things. We know they were there.
Certainly,
but what we're dealing with is whether or not it endangered the child at that point in time.
Yes, Your Honor. And the combination of the money, the handgun, the drugs, and the furtive movements towards the center of the console gave rise to a reasonable inference that the trial court expressly drew that the drug activity was ongoing in this case. And the defendant into that environment that the trial court characterized as an illicit mobile pharmacy or a mobile drug house buckled a child, and he engaged in that armed drug activity in the front seat with his 2 to 3-year-old child in the back seat. And it is that activity that subjects this child to a substantial risk of serious injury.
I mean, the risk of injury to the child, from what I understand, is if you're dealing drugs out of the car. Because dealing drugs is inherently a dangerous activity. It's cash-based business, and we see all the time drug dealers being robbed and things going bad in the context of drug dealing. But and that's the problem is, yes, he's possessing with intent to distribute, but there's a complete absence of evidence that he was coming from a drug deal, going to a drug deal, such that the child was in some kind of imminent harm, as opposed to a remote speculative possibility of harm.
Certainly, Your Honor. And again, I would point to the crumpled and unsorted $700 in his front pockets, which the trial court heard expert testimony was as a result. Drug dealers often have that kind of money unsorted because when you're dealing drugs, you need to move the money quickly. You don't take time to sort and fold your bills.
So your point is he wasn't going to get infant formula with those crumpled bills?
No, Your Honor. Not with a loaded semi-automatic weapon, an unregistered, unlicensed, concealed semi-automatic weapon with a round of live ammunition in the chamber combined with the illicit pharmacy in the console. There were three men in that car total as well as the child. There were scales in the trunk, and I believe this would be a different situation if not all of those factors were present, but certainly from the totality of those circumstances.
Did the fact finder have to believe the defendant's self-serving testimony that he was just going to the hospital? He wasn't actually going to do anything bad with his weapons and his cachet of scales and drugs?
No, Your Honor. Of course, the trial court was entitled to reject that.
But I guess the question I have is, does the Commonwealth have to prove that he was going to do it? I mean, I certainly can understand if he was, like, in a place where there drug activity is going on and there's somebody coming up to his window to get something from him. Okay. Well, it seems like to me he's dealing drugs from a car. But when somebody's driving down a road with three other people and a kid strapped in the back seat and we don't know where they're going, that's all you can say, why would you assume they were going to be dealing the drugs out of the car as opposed to, you know, going somewhere to put one of his runners out and put the drugs in his pocket and have him talk to people to see if anybody wants to buy any? Why would you assume that they're going to deal out of the car? And that's why I see the lack of evidence. I just don't see any evidence that the man has ever sold any drugs out of this car or anybody observed anything like that happening.
Well, Your Honor, I think at this point, here on the sufficiency of the evidence challenge and taking all those facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, the trial court's inference in this situation was a reasonable one. And the trial court wasn't required to needed to find the officer observed a hand-to-hand transaction before
or that he was in an area that a hand-to-hand transaction would occur, or that when it ever occurred, he just can assume that if he had it in the car, he probably was going to sell it out of the car.
Well, again, Your Honor, I would disagree with the characterization that the other evidence in this case considered together didn't establish this was ongoing drug activity in light of the firearm with the round of live ammunition in the chamber, the money, the furtive movements towards the center console. The trial court essentially found that these items were out in the car and that they were shoved in the center console when the defendant was unexpectedly pulled over by Officer Dalton. And that's a reasonable interpretation of the facts here. And the trial court was entitled to draw those inferences. And certainly being in the vehicle with a defendant who does have the intent to distribute, he's not simply driving, he's in a vehicle with drugs packaged for distribution with the intent to distribute with a loaded handgun, with crumpled money, with scales, and with other adults in the car, whose presence is unexplained at this point, with no reasonable explanation for why he has all of those things. Certainly under those circumstances, the trial court, as a matter of common sense, as this court found in Duncan, could find that that child was endangered, and it is the combination of all those factors that give rise to that reasonable inference.
Before you sit down, did the evidence demonstrate that he was a previously convicted felon as well?
Your Honor, I don't believe so.
All right, but you do have the possession of a concealed weapon, obviously, without a permit to conceal it. You also have the simultaneous possession of unlawful drugs and the possession of a firearm simultaneously, which is also separately illegal.
Yes.
Now, we spent a lot of time talking about whether or not this placed a child in danger. And do you have to actually have ongoing dealing to have the child be in danger? I wonder if one of the best arguments the Commonwealth has that the defendant thought he was in danger because he was breaking two and maybe more laws by carrying a concealed weapon in the car himself, because even the defendant knows the enterprise that he's in is dangerous.
Yes, Your Honor.
Absolutely. Wouldn't that be the best argument the Commonwealth would have?
And the trial court certainly relied on the fact that the defendant armed himself in that manner before engaging in this dangerous activity, demonstrating knowledge that it was dangerous.
So it's not really a function of whether or not you're currently dealing. It's a function of this is what you do. And he knows it's dangerous, and he's armed because of it.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that character.
But I guess the problem, it seems like to me, with that is going to be, why wouldn't that be true with any adult who has a loaded gun in their car and has a child there? Because obviously they must think they're in danger. They're riding around with a loaded weapon. There are a lot of citizens who do have weapons that they ride around with that are loaded.
Of course, Your Honor. But hopefully in that circumstance they wouldn't be illegally concealed handguns. They would be appropriately permitted by a law-abiding citizen. And also I think there's a difference here in that the defendant was engaging in illegal activity, an inherently dangerous illegal activity, when he decided also to arm himself there. I think this court considered in Carosi that non-illicit objects can pose harm to children, for example, drugs under the sink, or any other number of legal items.
I was just dealing with the issue of whether or not someone thought they were in danger because they had a loaded weapon in their vehicle.
I think it's one factor among many to consider, Your Honor, certainly, and it has more weight given the other dangerous illegal activity that was going on in this case.
Can you, before you quit, briefly describe the holding and the essential fact patterns of our Carosi opinion?
Sure, Your Honor. So Carosi was a case that was decided under the Child Endangerment Statute, which is under 40.1. However, as this court noted, these two cases have the same mental state. It's criminal negligence, reckless disregard for human life. And in that case, the defendant had drugs in a wardrobe, and this court held that it wasn't prepared to say that no reasonable fact finder could find that rearing a child in an environment with unsupervised access to drugs didn't endanger the life of that child. And in that case, the court specifically refused to read Jones as requiring both access to drugs and illicit drug dealing before criminal negligence could be found. And here we kind of have the inverse of that case. Certainly we don't have the child having access on these facts to the drugs in the console, but we do have that exposure to illegal drug activity, so it's kind of the inverse of Carosi, but I would suggest that the outcome should be the same.
What is the exposure to illegal drug activity? The fact that it was just there? The proximity?
No, Your Honor, it's more than the proximity. It's the intent to distribute, the nature and character of those drugs, in addition to, as I've said, the money in his pocket, the scales in the car, the trial court's finding that this was an illicit mobile pharmacy, a mobile drug
house. The nub of your argument is that there's no direct evidence that he was coming from or heading to a drug deal, but that given the cash, the loaded gun, and the drugs, it was a reasonable inference from those facts that that's what he was actually up to, combined with the fact that you can disregard his testimony about going to the hospital.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think it's significant that we're talking about the confines of a two-door sedan. And this is not a house where the child could duck under the bed if something bad was happening, or it could be shielded from the child by being kept in a wardrobe or kept in a different room. This child is seated directly behind the driver in what the trial court described as an illicit mobile pharmacy, in the close confines of that sedan, two-door sedan. This child could not be shielded from those dangers.
All right, thank you very much. Your time has expired. Rebuttal?
Just very briefly, I think I've got 40 seconds. The issue here is if he's, there is no evidence whatsoever to support that he was engaged in drug dealing at the time. The trial judge is in error in characterizing it, in essentially saying because he's got these substances in the car and a handgun that he's a mobile pharmacy.
What about the law of the case? The convictions are not appealed, and therefore we take as a given without any sufficient examination that at the moment he was in the car with the child, he possessed everything, and at that moment he intended to do a drug deal. He may have not actually turned the drugs over to the guy next to him, but he intended at that moment to distribute drugs, and that's not something we can second-guess at this step.
I have a present intent in 5 minutes to leave this courtroom. I'm not driving right now. And so that's the difference. The judge, to find a conviction with possession with intent, what has to be present at the time is my intent to do something. Not right now, maybe this weekend, maybe later this afternoon. The present intent is different with regards to finding possession with intent to distribute. It's the intention that has to be present. It's not the activity. And the trial court marries those two. It ignores that, basically decides that because he's a drug dealer, that the child is forever exposed to the activity. And again, that's an error. And I don't think there's evidence to support the trial court's finding that he was engaged at that time. There was lots of evidence about distribution versus possession and quantities and crumpled bills and that kind of thing. But to conclude that he was a drug dealer is different than to conclude he was engaged in that activity right that moment. Thank you. I think that's all.
Thank you very much. Call the next.